Chester, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is a professor of economics emeritus at Texas A&M, a former chief economist in the Department of Labor. He served as the director of the Criminal Justice Center and is a senior fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis in Dallas, Texas. And he's a very controversial fellow in the 9/11 community. I hold him in high esteem, and I thought it would be great to have him back on the show again to talk about 9/11 research in general. It's a great pleasure to welcome back Morgan Reynolds. Morgan, welcome.
Thank you, Jim. Good to be back.
Real pleasure. Tell me some of your thoughts. I was listening to the interview with Judy Wood and Jerry Liepart on Kevin's program last Friday, and it struck me that the first caller, obviously was there to be provocative because he started raising questions about the implausibility of directed energy weapons, for example, when the discussion up to that point in time had already laid a foundation for the necessity for unconventional weapons, the absence of the debris pile. It's very interesting that not only was there no pile, but Frank Morales, who was down there that day as an Episcopal priest who was administering last rites, if only they could find the bodies, told me that not only was there no pile, there was actually a pit. There were actually two pits, two enormous pits. So not only was there no pile, there were actually pits. And for this guy to go on and on, about claiming that he stopped listening to me when I had Judy on back on the 11th of November, it seems to me to all by itself, by his own admission, disqualify himself because he cannot know all the developments that have been taking place that are discussed on shows like mine and virtually no other in the whole year virtually since he ceased listening. So this was a very troublesome call, but not at all unexpected.
Yeah, the first question I think Kevin should have asked is, well, why are you listening tonight if you stop listening to me and Jim Fetzer? And, you know what? I think that's
a great point, Morgan. How could he? Know to call in tonight?
You know, the day before, Dr. Wood was on Ambrose Lane's "We Ourselves" in the District of Columbia, and the first caller there was also hostile, anti-Judy Wood. So my first thought was, hey, they're trolling, they're monitoring any show Judy's on. It's very much like the forums. Judy is so important that they've got to create confusion, and they're niggling little efforts to try and offset the truth. So I don't trust Solomon from Canada. Now, the other major part about this was Kevin has made some progress intellectually, but it wasn't much in evidence in his reaction there. And this happened about 40 minutes into the program, and Jerry Liepart had pretty much dominated when you had the two guests on, and he's the attorney who's... clients include me and Dr. Wood on 9/11 issues. So what was especially annoying at that point was that Kevin went on for a seeming it was a good 5 minutes. We could replay it. 5 minutes answering for Dr. Wood. Here, this Solomon's attacking Dr. Wood's work. And she's a guest.
Well,
lose.
I actually just replayed that first 40 or 50 minutes just before our show, Morgan. And actually, Judy made a remark later that I thought was striking, namely how when Kevin was responding to Solomon's complaint that I hadn't allowed Steve Jones to talk, Judy was observing here, he was complaining about me talking over Steve Jones, and right there on the show, he was talking over Judy Wood.
I know. I know. And
funny. Now, you know, just to say a word on behalf of Kevin, I think he was trying to suggest, after all, he had endorsed the idea that there had to have been unconventional modes of destruction involved here, given the amount of devastation. He was endorsing the idea of a conjunction, that it could be both conventional plus unconventional, rather than making it an exclusive disjunction where you have one or the other, but not both.
Well, he was, but I doubt that Dr. Wood, and I don't want to put words in her mouth, but we have worked very closely for over 2 years now. And, no, I should say one. Correct myself. The Kevin isn't going to get the details, if you want to put it that way, right. And in this particular sense, it occurs to me that an article that Dr. Wood and I did deserves more attention. And I can't remember the exact title, but it's on her website. It's something like a scientific investigation of the thermite hypothesis. And that one hasn't received that much attention, but we start off, okay, you know, Dr. Jones keeps on preaching to us and others about the scientific method. I think we get the scientific method, you know. Don't talk down to me, buddy. And then we apply the same tools to his thermite hypothesis. Well, it fails miserably. Proof of concept. Where has thermite ever been used in a controlled demolition? There's none on record. And on and on. We just take it apart. How are you going to ignite all this thermite? How much thermite's going to take? You know, on and on. Any video of either tower being blown to kingdom come will easily falsify a thermite hypothesis or any variation on a collapse.
But,
it wasn't a collapse.
Right, right. I agree completely. The use of the word collapse is a mistake from the beginning. Yeah.
To go back to your original, when Kevin's trying to talk about overkill, well, that violates the KISS rule. Hey, if you've got a directed energy weapon and you've already used the gizmo, for example, as we suspect on the Oklahoma City bombing, that wasn't any ammonium nitrate truck bomb. where are the truck parts, you know? On and on. And Judy on her site has a pair of pictures, one from the interior of WTC-6, where there's a very little debris on the bottom, looking up from the ground floor, and it resembles the other picture, which is the Murrah building. Half the Murrah building disappeared.
Well, I do recall, Morgan, that there were firefighters on the scene who were bringing out unexploded devices that were attached to the major pillars in the Murrah building, which might suggest a combination of causes in that case, too. Listen, we're getting feedback from your phone. I'm going to see if Donovan can reconnect so we can get rid of that.
All right.
But, you know, Kevin, I think, it was indulging this fellow Solomon when I think Solomon probably really wasn't entitled to as much time as he gave him. But, of course, it can be a tricky business when you're hosting one of these shows to be fair and balanced, which I think he was striving to do.
Yeah. Well, on the other side of the ledger, I'd say Kevin has come a long way here in entertaining. He plugged Dr. Wood's site regarding all the evidence, whether or not you come to a directed energy conclusion or not.
Yeah, and I think that's extremely important. Everyone should study drjudywood.com. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today is Morgan Reynolds, who is a student of many subjects, not just economics, but in relation to 9/11, he has a special interest in the planes at all four sites and has developed quite a powerful critique for the claim that there were planes at any of those sites in accordance with the government's official account. We're talking a bit about an exchange between Judy Wood and Jerry Liepart and a caller from Canada who identified himself as Solomon to Kevin Barrett, who was hosting the show on Friday. I just say, Morgan, two more indications that Solomon wasn't serious but was a plant include his use of the phrase, space beams to describe Judy's work, and, of course, to mention Greg Jenkins' hit piece. I mean, both of those, of course, are so distorted and warped. These kinds of weapons can be based on satellites or reflected by mirrors on satellites. They can be airborne. They could be on dirigibles. They could be an aircraft like a 747 mounted laser. They could be ground-based. There are all those possibilities. Judy's never committed herself to one or the other, though, of course, on that particular show, she raised the possibility they were from space. I was so fascinated by all of the evidence she had adduced on her website and by the fact that we were entering a whole new realm of thinking, you know, conjecturing, speculating, which is an indispensable step in scientific reasoning, that some of those who heard me respond with, you know, saying how fantastic I thought it was may have mistakenly supposed I was thereby endorsing the very specific hypothesis rather than the range of alternatives and the evidence she was producing. And, of course, anyone who, you know, listens to the Greg Jenkins video, which was a hit piece, and I was there when it took place, and it was obvious to me already that there were serious problems with the way he was conducting himself, and does not go to Judy's site to see the transcript analyzed, is to me being very dishonest, because they're looking at one side of the evidence but not the other. So in this case, he's using loaded language, evaluative language, describing a space beam, which is obviously grossly biased, and then he's not going to look at the other side of the Greg Jenkins hit piece, where you'd see that actually Judy was very successful in coping with a lot of verbal traps that were being laid by Jenkins, which she was deftly avoiding.
Yeah, it seems like he had the talking points memo in his hand, because he referred to Judy Wood, if memory serves, but Dr. Gregory S. Jenkins.
Very nice.
He's a PhD physicist, so but here again, I have to come back and blame Kevin for intervening here. And, you know, Solomon attacked the Fetzer and Barrett. So Kevin might have taken a special interest. That may be a natural explanation. But still, you got the scientists there. And, Jim, just to give you of course, I'm a co-author on this piece. The dissertation piece. But, of course, when we started in on this, I said, Judy, you have to be the lead author. You're the lead physical scientist, and I'm basically an inexpensive but bright assistant, okay?
This is not the inexpensive.
Well, I didn't realize, and I said, of course, we knew that she would be taking a lot of arrows in the back, being the lead here. But I didn't quite appreciate at the time how much that is true.
Well, you know, Morgan, something that puzzles me is why anyone would suppose that physicists are the end-all or the be-all. As you work your way up, you know, in terms of the complexity of matter, you get more and more complicated kinds of relationships. The laws aren't simply those of physics alone, but they get more complicated. If you go to chemistry, or if you go to biology, or you move to psychology, we're talking about much, much more complicated interrelationships than physicists deal with. And when you have somebody who has expertise, who has actually degrees in civil engineering with an emphasis in structural and engineering mechanics, which is applied physics, and in materials engineering science, which seems to me the single discipline most relevant to all these matters, I cannot appreciate why anyone would suppose that a mere physicist is even potentially going to rival the expertise of someone with a PhD in materials engineering science.
Yeah, just to be slightly flippant about it, it may be the case that physicists are educated beyond their capability. I've got one of Dr. Wood's textbooks. Actually, this is sophomore level engineering, Vector Mechanics for Engineers, Statics.
Okay.
And this is the seventh edition, so this thing has sold well. And here at the front end, you have the first few pages is what I'm interested in, where we have Newton's laws and a couple of others that, and just a quote here on, let's see, on page 5, the six fundamental principles listed above are based on experimental evidence. And they go to a little bit about that, and they say, it was only in the last century that Newton's mechanics was found at fault in the study of the motion of atoms and in the study of the motion of certain planets, where it must be supplemented by the theory of relativity. But on the human or engineering scale, where velocities are small compared with the speed of light, Newton's mechanics has yet to be disproved. And I think what we can say is they haven't found a single exception. So, for example, the reason that this is very important to me is, let's say Stephen Jones, he's a PhD-trained physicist. How can he talk about me being a rabid no-planer when I say no aluminum airplane can fly into a steel and concrete tower and not lose a flap or a panel?
Right? You know, a nice observation Veronica Chapman made to me the other day is how there's a tendency here to ignore the fact that the engines in these planes are made of steel. I mean, they have titanium and other parts, but after all, principally steel. So if a jet fuel-based fire would cause steel to melt, then those engines would be melting and the planes would be falling out of the sky.
You know, it just gets silly. Hey, I always go back. You have to go back to the fundamentals, something you really get your arms around and understand. A lot of this more complicated modeling, if it doesn't comport with common sense, no matter how refined, it's a gobbledygook, it's drivel. I've sat through many a seminar in economics and see that it's just a mishmash. And people say, oh, Morgan's not being polite. What? I'm not going to swallow this stuff. What do you mean I'm not polite? That's the culture of economists, is to not be polite.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, reasonable discourse doesn't require a great deal of civility. I mean, it requires a commitment to rationality and objectivity.
Yeah. Why is it civil to just be a laydown for what you perceive to be a false argument? Let's have it out. Let's hear both sides.
Yeah. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today is Morgan Reynolds. And Morgan is really so well known to this community that he really doesn't require an introduction, but he's already had one.
Redundant, what? Jim, you're being redundant.
Morgan, my technical assistant raised an interesting question that's been bothering him for some time, which is this, you know, that if thermite is some combination of aluminum powder and ferric oxide, is it possible that it could have been some aluminum from the skin of the planes that was combining with ferric oxide, which is, I gather, you know, a form of rust is a form of ferric oxide, that could have caused these residues that are being interpreted as the result of thermite, and it could have been from a thermite-like reaction. Is that a possibility, do you know?
Well, of course, no planes crash.
So right.
It can't be aluminum from a plane. If you ask me, yeah.
If I ask you,
then I'll start out proving it. Yeah.
Do you know as an alternative whether
the Stephen Jones Group filed an appeal with NIST recently. I've got it right on my computer here. And if I go, I'll find out what day it was, but very recent.
Right.
And, there's no date on the front end, so I'll have to go to the back end and see if I can find a date. A couple days ago, at any rate.
I printed it off to read it through myself. I have it upstairs.
Okay, here's the date at the bottom. It's October 25. So in there, one of their what I call 16 points that I had summarized for our group, they scold NIST for not testing for thermite residue. NIST would have to have some reason to do so, but it's a very carefully stated proposition. It's just an if A, then B. They don't actually contend an alternative theory about what destroyed the Trade Center towers. So to me, their appeal is a very restrictive, kind of a Casper milquetoast. Most of their objections take the form of, well, we're on NIST modeling turf, but they didn't go far enough. You know, they didn't do enough with the least severe damage modeling, and they didn't reveal enough about the parameters here or the data set. But in any event, NIST, I think, will put that to one side because it's not a well-argued, strong alternative in this appeal. They just basically make an if A then B statement. They cite a website here, Materials Engineering Inc. In fact, I went and looked on Google, and when I just Googled thermite and arson, okay, because this Materials Engineering Inc. says they'll go and investigate with their hotshot equipment for traces of thermite compound, as well as visual evidence, and with absolute certainty tell you whether it was present. Well, in the first two pages of Google, that was the only non-9/11 reference to thermite and arson. And Dr. Wood was telling me earlier today that she'd heard from some kind of a firefighting authority that they've never seen thermite used as an arson initiator. And why would you use thermite, you know, spark-throwing a steel welder or cutter when you can use gasoline and matches?
Sure.
If they're equally detectable, you know. So,
yeah.
Anyway, the whole this if A then B statement about thermite is a very restricted kind of an odd thing that the Jones Group is bringing to NIST.
Yeah.
Because they don't argue really. Here's our evidence. We believe thermite was used or some variation. They don't make that argument.
You know, when I had questions early on about whether thermite or thermate could possibly account for the massive destruction, I asked Steve in the lobby out at the American Scholars Conference in Los Angeles whether, you know, super thermate was supposed to be the answer. You know, could it have done all of this? And he assured me that it could have. But, you know, honestly, I don't know where we get a source on super thermate and whether that's just not another, you know, magic clanger being plunked.
Well, and most of Jones' defenders these days say, oh, he didn't say that anywhere. And that might well be true, but he certainly was leaving everybody with that impression that thermite or one of its variations was the destructive main vehicle of destruction. And now he says, in conjunction with or with other explosives, by which he means conventional explosives like RDX or related. But, you know, one time, it's on record, he said on the Bonnie Faulkner show out there, and that's in the Bay Area, right, Guns and Butter, he said, well, thermite doesn't have tags. And that's the neat part about it, whereas these other explosives have tags, and you can identify and trace back to the buyer or exploder or the evil exploder. So now he seems to be, that is, Professor Jones, seems to be mixing the two and allowing thermite with, you know, the unidentifiability, the untagged common accessibility of it. And now it's a jumble right now.
Well, he certainly said to me that, you know, super thermate could cause this explosion, you know, these effects that were observed at the World Trade Center, though, of course, when he published his paper in the Griffin Scott edited collection on 9/11 and American Empire, he was, you know, expressing astonishment over the pulverization of the top 30 floors of the South Tower, when it started to tilt over and then just disappeared.
Yeah, turned to dust.
He was, you know, I mean, it was as though this was one of the most astonishing events in the history of physics, and I think in some sense or other it was.
And, and he just left it as some mystery or anomaly, made no attempt in that volume to explain it. But he did recognize it happened.
Yes, which is commendable in and of itself, of course.
Right.
The RDX business, I take it, does have tags. Maybe HDX has tags, too. But that means to me that the thermate is kind of an anonymous. I mean, so far as I know, we have never discovered any tags from RDX or HDX. Is that not right?
I don't know. I haven't investigated that. But I'm just going. I'm replaying what he said to Bonnie Faulkner, and it's these explosives, I think, would have tags. Here again, I haven't investigated.
Yeah. Well, at the time when I was looking into it, it was evident that RDX did have these tags and that none of them had turned up. And that suggested, of course, that the combination didn't look very likely given the evidence. We'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. With my special guest today, Morgan Reynolds, and we're just reflecting on the 9/11 movement and its ups and downs and vicissitudes. Morgan, this point about RDX is very interesting because we have a recent blog by George Washington, whom, of course, is Alex Flom, talking about how, from the point of view of establishing a legal case, he thinks the obligation is on the 9/11 community to prosecute the perps. And I find this whole thing very strange because, basically, I mean, the government bears the burden of proof to establish that its official story is correct, which it sought to do using the 9/11 Commission. And what we have been doing is to demonstrate that the 9/11 Commission report is unsustainable, that it's provably false in virtually every significant respect. Plus, of course, until you reach the point of actually understanding what's happened, I don't see how you can even begin to contemplate a legal case. So all this seems to me to be not only premature in terms of our state of scientific knowledge, but also backwards. I just don't understand how someone who is an attorney could be making arguments of the quality of those that are being presented in this blog from George Washington.
Well, the I actually have a little trace of sympathy for the prosecution framework, but so if you were to were responsible for prosecuting the perps, what you have to do is show evidence that stands tall. That is, the defense cannot undermine it or refute it. And once you set up a string of evidence that proves up every element of the charge, then the jury is left with no alternative but to say these facts have no other explanation but that the perps are guilty as charged. And this business about while it is important, of course, and it's been shown, as you say, in just about every dimension that the official story cannot possibly be true, we don't want to draw some kind of bright line and confine ourselves. It's better for us to push forward at all the vulnerable points we can to learn as much as we can and as much as we can prove. For example, I get accused of saying, oh, you know, this no plane stuff is just so silly. It's pure conjecture, speculation. And that's just flat wrong. I come in with some heavy timber. You know, let's get down to the cases and look at the evidence. For example, you know, hunt the plane debris, right? You know, hunt the Boeing. where are all these parts, you know? And Ace Baker, a friend of ours, has a little thing on his website we might want to look at where he looks at the ghost plane penetration. And you see the building, the columns heal themselves up. You know, it's just, in other words, we have a lot going here, and it's evidence.
Yeah.
Evidence.
Hold up one second. I think if you pull the phone about an inch away, it might be
okay.
Get
that?
Rid of that resonance.
Is that better?
Yeah, it is, actually.
Okay.
Now, the thing that strikes me, Morgan, among other points, is not only that there's a lot of evidence about some of these controversial issues, but that the one that George Washington would defend, the thermite business, doesn't point in any specific direction. I mean, if thermite has no tags, then how do you track it? If thermite can be bought on eBay, as I understand, then I don't see how the thermite hypothesis is particularly helpful in prosecuting anyone in particular. On the other hand, if in fact some kind of high-tech weapon that would be the exclusive prerogative of the American military or the industrial complex is involved. That seems to me far more weighty as evidence in terms of impugning the American military and its character, or the government and the administration in this crime.
Well, there's two levels. Yeah, certainly it's true that if the evidence points to a use of a directed energy or certainly some kind of exotic weapon that turned much of the World Trade Center to dust, then that does lead almost directly to the door of the Pentagon and its contractors. However, if the buildings were destroyed by thermite and there were no tags, well, then that would mean it would be harder to discover who did it, but we would have to go with it. It's just that there's really nothing going for the thermite hypothesis. If you look on the Wikipedia, for example, you know, what do you find thermite is used for? Well, it's like to join railroad tracks. It can cut steel and join
this
steel.
This ain't artillery. You drop it down the...
Right. And so it joins the steel and makes it unusable in that case, in an artillery piece.
Right.
So, this goes back to the what you termed, I believe, the barrenness of the research agenda when Dr. Jones first appeared on the scene back in September of 2005.
Well,
it was his hypothesis that thermite brought down the WTC-7. Well, why be that narrow, that specific, that thermite? You know, why are we all focused on thermite? Instead, you know, the way a real scientist would or a criminal investigator would proceed to look at the site, the evidence you could gather up about what happened.
Well, I'm seeking to cast this in the framework of criminal prosecution as advocated by George Washington. I'm not sure he's thought this through. I mean, if you haven't actually figured out how it was done, how can you possibly establish the nexus of proof that connects the alleged perpetrators with the crime? I mean, really, truly, and if it was thermite, that seems to me all the more difficult. But in any case, what's the point of attempting to undertake any kind of action until you really have figured out what actually happened, which requires a very thorough, painstaking scientific investigation?
Well, I don't quite agree with you, and I'll explain why. But Alex Flom, you know what the upshot of that is, what he's really seeking out to do. I did read that piece, but it's been a while. But you know what he's really trying to do is get everybody in the corral. That is the politically correct 9/11 truth movement corral, and that means to leave the no plane and the do work outside. Outside the proper bounds, because supposedly that's harder to prove. No, it's not.
Well, listen. Here's my take on this, Morgan. That's absolutely right. That it was kind of an appeal to ignorance in the sense that he was saying he knew of no proof that, you know, no planes or do or video fakery, but he's not looked for proof. You know, it's like the man who's lost his keys and he searches under the streetlight, even though it's far removed from where he dropped them, because the light's better. I mean,
what he's doing
is even, I think, more deliberate and self-conscious and trying to suggest that jurors would have a hard time believing no planes or video fakery or do, but he's ignoring evidence. I mean, jurors aren't going to believe anything willy-nilly right off the top unless there's proof. And in Judy, it seems to me, has adduced a huge amount of evidence that unconventional weapons had to be involved. And you and Ace Baker and others have adduced a huge amount of evidence for video fakery and raised the real possibility that no planes were involved. I mean, certainly if planes were involved, they cannot have conformed to what is seen in the video fakery, which raises the point that the video fakery could have been to conceal features of the planes or their interaction with the buildings. I'll be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays. And I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today, Morgan Reynolds, former chief economist of the Department of Labor. Donovan, we got an overlap. We got an overlap with another show there. My former chief economist with the Department of Labor in the George W. Bush administration, and really extraordinary fellow, and I'm just delighted to have him back on the show again. We're talking about 9/11, research community, this and that, and the tension between the activists and the researchers. And you know, Morgan, this business about the court case, I just was really troubled when there was the San Francisco People's Grand Jury that Jim Hoffman and Don Paul organized and coordinated, which turned out to be a bit of a fiasco, according to a couple of the members of the jury. They never actually had the opportunity to deliberate, and yet Don Paul went ahead and issued a statement of indictments that was led by no less an eminence than David Rockefeller. And yet I doubt very much they could possibly connect people like Rockefeller to any of the evidence they were discussing, such as it may have been. So I was very troubled by that, thought it was not only a shoddy piece of work, but that it placed in jeopardy the very idea of bringing subsequent legal action if, as you have observed on many occasions, you only get one bite of the apple.
Right, and, you know, doesn't that do something to harm the credibility of the 9/11 truth movement? I'm always being accused of undermining that. But here you got a rush to judgment where the jurors don't get any time to consider what they want to say. Now, this business about picturing yourself as a prosecutor has virtue. And I want to make two points here. And first of all, prosecutors never have all the facts, but you don't need all the facts. What you need are crucial facts that the defense finds it impossible ultimately to undermine. And the jurors are always the ultimate triers of fact. So you're always incomplete. You don't have to know everything about the crime to get convictions. So you get convictions by the thousands every day with less than that. And I have a son who's an attorney, and he's a former prosecutor, and he's a criminal defense attorney, so he's got a lot of experience about that. My second point is that I have a key TAM case, as you know.
Yes.
Regarding the plane fraud and the contractors who worked for NIST. And my key TAM case is filed in the federal district court blocks from the World Trade Center, where the main event took place. And in that key TAM case, while I am the plaintiff, I represent the United States of America in that case against the NIST contractors. Now, in a sense, while I am the plaintiff, and it's a civil case, in a sense, I am the prosecutor. The burden really is on me to prove it up that these guys have done dirt to the American public, NIST, and the American taxpayers, and therefore really the globe, because we know that 9/11 is the false pretext for all the ill that has followed. And while I do have a lower standard than the criminal standard, I only have to have the preponderance of the evidence. I look forward in we got a lot of obstacles to surmount, but I look forward to the day when we can bring this into a court of law.
I'm enthralled with all of that, Morgan. I think the key TAM cases are sensational. And one respect in which I would fault Kevin during his program was he seemed to be hung up on the requests for correction and didn't seem to grasp that these key TAM cases are even more important and actually are successors of the requests for correction in various respects in relation to the evidence and so forth. My point actually is a rather different one. Namely, you can't go after the perps unless you have a causal nexus that ties the perps to the crime by way of evidence. And it seems to me that this business about thermite, even thermite residues, is unlikely to do that. Now, you know, I raised that question about from my technical assistant about whether, you know, aluminum powder plus ferric oxide could have been related to the planes. And while you, of course, deny the planes. Judy has observed in an email that there's a lot of aluminum cladding on the building, you know, in relation to steel columns because it was used as decoration. So the question arises again, is it possible that what Stephen Jones is taking to be evidence of thermite was in fact an interaction of aluminum cladding with ferric oxide that produced a similar result? I'm just raising the question. And here's another related issue too, Morgan, you know, where there's a citation of this stream of what looks like liquid metal of some kind coming from one floor, and I think it's the 80th floor, and I think we're talking about the South Tower. I mean, there are all kinds of possibilities if that actually is the South Tower, and I don't know why I can't recall off the top of my head whether it was the North or the South, but I think it was the South Tower. I mean, given the plane hit on the South Tower on the 80th floor, I presume, by the way, of course, that the alternative explanation is not that this was molten aluminum, although it could have been molten aluminum. It looks like molten aluminum, as Judy and her students have shown, notwithstanding that Steve insists that it cannot be molten aluminum, because molten aluminum would look different. I think he's just wrong on the facts, on the observable phenomena there. But the offer I have made, the suggestion I've made, is that this was a Fuji Bank building floor, and it appears to have been covered with batteries. Batteries have a much lower melting temperature than steel or aluminum, and I think it's actually a residue from melted batteries they had there to provide an electrical backup in case there was a failure in the energy to maintain their client's records.
I haven't seen enough to on that issue to come to that conclusion. I really doubt the pictures and the videos that there was this stream of molten metal.
Oh, you think that raw evidence itself may have been faked?
Or the liquid? Yes. Or was this liquid really some kind of water or?
Okay.
Other bright work. I don't know.
Let me pick up on that, Morgan. What you're saying is here you have some evidence or photographs where there are multiple alternative interpretations. Okay, maybe it's molten metal from thermite, but maybe it's some molten aluminum, or maybe it's molten lead, or maybe the photos have been faked. What kind of evidence is that to take into court? There are multiple reasonable alternative explanations.
Yeah, you know, the standards are very high to get video or pictures into court, because you got to have the original photographer testify. You got to have evidence that regarding the chain of custody, and finally, evidence that there is no manipulation.
Most of
this stuff that people fuss about is inadmissible.
Do you know what? This is a long history. This video fakery. Even Arthur Conan Doyle was involved in faking some photographs of fairies, if you can believe that.
And hey, you made a really important point, a very general point about the causal nexus. Yes, you've got to demonstrate that you've got evidence that stands tall and points leaves you no other reasonable explanation but that the accused did it. Now, what is very disturbing about thermite is, suppose thermite did bring down the building. Well, you can recall President George W. Bush in the Rose Garden claiming that, oh yeah, KSM has given us a lot of information about how they bring buildings down from the top to the bottom or whatever.
Hold that thought, Morgan. We'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds, on the Dynamic Duo. Today, my special guest, Morgan Reynolds, and I are discussing the 9/11 research community, its goals, objectives, and methods, and we're right now talking about the possibility of bringing a lawsuit and the problems about establishing a causal nexus with the perps, which seems to be something that Alex Flum in his recent George Washington blog has overlooked, or at least not assessed adequately, because we find, for example, in some of the thermite evidence, like the alleged molten metal pouring out of the 80th floor window, that there are multiple alternative explanations, and that therefore, as evidence, it doesn't carry much weight. Plus, we know there are other photographs that are supposed to support the molten metal hypothesis, such as the cavern where you're surrounded by workers, where the skin would be peeling off of their faces and arms if, in fact, that were an authentic photograph of molten metal at around 3,000 degrees. And I like to pull up the parallel, Morgan, with anyone, you know, put their face over the spout of a tea kettle once it starts to whistle, when that's only around 212 degrees. So you wouldn't do that without being scalded. The idea of 3,000 degrees is simply ludicrous. So we know some of the evidence here has been faked, and the question becomes how much more. Alex Flom seems to me to completely finesse that question. Not only that, but, of course, he appears to be vastly ignorant of all the research that's been done on video fakery and no planes, not to mention on the possibility of directed energy weapons.
Let's get down to brass tacks, Jim. I like this alleged quote, or at least the statement attributed to V.I. Lenin.
Yeah.
We shall control the opposition by leading it. And we've got to acknowledge the big picture here. The perps knew there would be people on their trail. They didn't realize, I think, how far we've come, how fast, okay? They didn't plan on that. But the 9/11 truth movement is designed to control the opposition and to slow the path. And it's very obvious that Thermite and the like are just fallback positions to play out the clock and take us down the road of the JFK investigations, which really have been proved up, but slow it down, make it last 40 years plus, and then all the perps are well in their grave anyway.
And they've achieved their objectives in the meanwhile,
including what they wanted to achieve. And then it's all cold. The emotion has gone out of it.
Ancient
somehow,
history.
Yeah, it becomes a Gulf of Tonkin or the Operation Northwoods, and
yeah.
On and on. The babies in the the Kuwait baby hoax of the Iraqi troops from,
that's right.
And on and on. So that's what they're trying to do. And we have people in our midst who don't identify them with themselves with a big button that says op, but they're working for the other side. And so it's a fallback position. It's very obvious that some untraceable, okay, demolitions brought it down. Well, the first candidate is OBL, and here we go again, right? So it's very got to be very disturbing to the perps that a Judy Wood was on the trail and really looked at the evidence at the site and ruled out any conventional explosives, which are not selective, for example. They're going to blow up pieces of concrete into chunks. They're going to blow aluminum cladding into chunks, and they're going to blow some of the steel into chunks. But what we have here is all the cladding virtually is still there, and yet most of the steel has disappeared into dust.
Well, you know, here, I'm not only troubled by the role of the truth and justice people who have, you know, been in the vanguard of attacking those who are doing serious research, like Judy and you, but a blogger in reinforcing a form of groupthink where if you don't conform to the most pedestrian approach here, then you're assailed by a pack of piranha. I mean, it's really unreal.
Mm-hmm.
What would happen even on my own blog, Morgan? I'd put up something that would explain why I had some reservations, say, about Steve Jones' research, for example. And I would be assailed. I mean, there would be 60 posts, and 58 of them would be accusing me of being an op or a disinformation artist. I mean, it was absurd, simply absurd.
Right.
Questions just like the ones we've been talking about here regarding the so-called pool of molten metal or the photograph and things like that. And then I was taken off completely. I was just cut off, and my blog was destroyed, which meant that, if you want to enforce conformity, by God, you're finding an effective way to do it because, you know, now I had no opportunity to even present an alternative point of view, much less my reasons for it.
Yeah, here we are, the land of the free. Judy has this quote, that's Dr. Wood, has a quote from, attributed to Harry Siegel, and it says, the likelihood of one individual being right increases in direct proportion to the intensity to which others are trying to prove him wrong.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Well, Jack White, a longtime researcher on JFK before he got involved in 9/11, and he and I got to know each other very well, offered the following principle. The more intensely they attack you and the more viciously, the more probable that you're right on the track of truth. And I think he's exactly right, because I saw this time and time again. I mean, the amount of assailing those of us who have done research on Zapruder film alteration, Morgan, which we have been able to establish objectively and scientifically to a, you know, overwhelmingly, and where anyone who's interested in that as an illustration can visit assassinationscience.com, scroll down to the JFK Introductory Symposium, and take a look at the introduction to the Zapruder film fakery by John P. Costella, Ph.D., a theoretical physicist, by the way, with expertise in electromagnetism and light and the properties of moving objects. And you'll go through the frames of the film. He'll show you exactly what evidence we have, even internal to the film, that the film cannot be authentic. And yet, we still are assailed by a student group out there who wants to ensure that the truth about these matters does not reach the American public, and therefore opposes it with great vehemence in order to create enough confusion that everything is believable and nothing is knowable unless you actually take the time and effort to study the evidence.
And bystanders, one good question to ask yourself is, do the critics come with evidence or logical arguments, or is it just merely smears and expressions of outrage and the like?
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Morgan Reynolds, are you there, Morgan?
Yes.
The key thing to me that I think people like Alex Flom haven't thought through is you can't just rush into court. I mean, it's this causal nexus business, but also establishing as a evidential foundation what actually happened. Judy emphasizes this all the time. You got to figure out what happened before you can begin to figure out how it happened and then be able to draw inferences about who could have been responsible. And to me, it is irresponsible to try to rush the cadence with regard to the idea of having a legal case before the scientific explanation has been established.
Well, yes and no. I think you're making the demands for a successful prosecution higher than they are in fact. One time I was the fourth person on a criminal jury panel, and so I saw a jury in motion. I played the impartial party, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
And people were very genuine. They understood the gravity of this, that we were preparing to use the state force in convicting somebody if we should so find. And it really said a lot good about the people from all walks of life. And the standards are that, of course, the proof, did the prosecution prove it up to you? Or do you think there's some reasonable explanation for these facts that are left on the table that the defendant wasn't guilty? And it didn't. In that case that I served on, we asked a question, a clarifying question of the judge, and the judge came back and just said, "You figure it out." He wouldn't make any attempt to clarify. I gather, since whatever he said might be used by one side or the other, you know, that was disadvantaged, but. It was a very rational outcome. So we don't have to have everything. You know, it's like the question: what happened to the all the passengers and things like that?
Morgan, I couldn't agree more with you about that, but. You can't just go willy-nilly in with a half-assed case. I mean, if there are reasonable alternatives to explain the so-called thermite evidence, then thermite can't possibly be a firm foundation for a legal procedure.
Yes, right. You cannot do that, and that's why in my Madison What Planes talk, I pointed that out. Right, you only get one bite of the cookie because of the prohibition on double jeopardy. You only get one chance to try the accused perpetrators.
So Alex Flom in his post was not only suggesting that because he said he hadn't seen any evidence that supported video fakery or no planes on the one hand, and presumably hadn't seen any evidence that supported unconventional weapons or directed energy on the other, that meant it would be unpersuasive to jurors if you went in to present such a case, but that's ignoring the fact that actually there's a tremendous amount of evidence. He just hasn't seen it.
Right. Why doesn't he... Why write about something when you're ignorant and admit it? It's just silly.
Well,
hey, Jim, I would like to turn you to one article of mine that is, let's see, that was over a year ago. If you go to my website,
nomoregames.net. Right. I'll go there right now.
And on the left-hand side, you click on 9/11 and scroll down, about two-thirds of the way.
Okay, one sec. I'm on 9/11. I'm scrolling down two-thirds of the way.
And the article is titled, Playing the 9/11 Unity Card.
Yes.
Click on that one.
Okay.
And I point out at the beginning that we have traitors like George W. Bush and Richard B. Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld.
Yes.
And that crew who wrapped themselves in the flag on 9/11.
Yes.
And listen to the, within 72 hours, George W. Bush goes over to the National Cathedral and delivers his remarks called, what does he call this? Warm Courage of National Unity. And he says in part, and I quote from the White House site, today we feel what Franklin Roosevelt called, quote, the warm courage of national unity. Of course, don't get me started on FDR. But then toward the end of this paragraph, it says, our unity is a kinship of grief and a steadfast resolve to prevail against our enemies. And this unity against terror is now extending across the world. Well, there is no mention of patriotism per se. That's not the word they use. It's called unity. And what we have in the 9/11 truth movement is the clarion call for unity.
Well,
so it's like the 9/11 truth movement's like a mirror image of Bush.
Well,
and what these people tell me and you is if you talk about X, Y, or Z, we'll lose all credibility with the public. That's what the unity correct.
Unity in the confrontation of controversy is a dictate for mediocrity because it requires lowest common denominator agreement.
A conformity to what the leaders demand. And as I say in this next sentence, hey, if I was concerned about credibility, I wouldn't have investigated or talked about 9/11 to begin with.
Well, look what else is absurd here, Morgan. He says this is a unity of every faith and every background when he's using it as the occasion to attack the Islamic community.
Oh.
This is a war against Islam.
It is. 1 billion people that they've made fabricated an enemy.
And as you say, if there are no planes, there are no hijackers. If there are no hijackers, there are no terrorists. If there are no terrorists, there are no Islamic terrorists. If there are no Islamic terrorists, then there's no war against Islam.
At least you could say at the first Pearl Harbor, the Japanese Navy really did attack Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
Japan was maneuvered into it, and they took the bait.
Right.
And FDR would have attacked Japan within a couple of weeks, but Japan obliged him. But what's so outrageous about 9/11 is that there are no Muslim hijackers. So the whole thing is fraudulent. As we know, of course, the FBI doesn't even want OBL, number one, most wanted for 9/11 because they have no hard evidence to bring to bear against OBL.
Yeah, it's really embarrassing. I mean, you know, that anyone should think that there's anything reasonable to be said for the government when the Bush himself conceded that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. The Senate Intelligence Committee and the Pentagon has reported that he wasn't in cahoots with Al Qaeda, and the FBI has acknowledged no hard evidence tying Osama bin Laden to 9/11. I mean, how stupid are we supposed to be? Morgan, pretty dumb, it seems to me. These guys are playing the American people for saps across the board.
Create money out of thin air.
Oh, yes.
For every single loan they issue.
Are we headed for a break, Jim?
Over the limit. In a moment.
Higher and higher interest rates.
If you go down below a couple more lines in this article, this article is dated, but there's a paragraph that begins pointing to scholar Kevin Barrett and others who talked about fake cell phone calls on TV.
Okay, we're actually off, Morgan. I didn't realize the sound didn't come up.
Okay.
We'll pick it up when we come back.
All right.
This week, today, I'm concluding a very interesting conversation with Morgan Reynolds about the 9/11 movement, activism, research, and now I think we're up to the issue of our commitment to truth. Morgan, would you like to continue?
Going back to this article, that is a good platform, I think, because it's over a year old, but Kevin Barrett and a few others talked about fake cell phone calls on TV.
Yes.
And Dan Abrahamson comes after them and says, does their speculation get us any closer toward building a nationwide political movement and arresting the 9/11 plotters? Or is it a divisive straw man that will isolate us from the mainstream media and average Americans? Well, it seems a little bit silly at this point that's one of the verboten issues you're supposed to raise.
Well,
you know that Dan Abrahamson is in charge of can say what about what's impossible on 9/11 and how the official story doesn't cut it at all. Who's Dan Abrahamson? Why am I supposed to take orders from Dan Abrahamson?
Well, what's interesting about his observation, Morgan, is it has nothing to do with a question of truth. He doesn't say, can we prove the phone calls are fake? And A.K. Dudney's research, among others, suggests that we can prove that it was fake.
Yeah.
If they were fake, then doesn't that indict the government, complicity in the cover-up because they're reporting cell phone calls that are fabricated? I mean, I think that's the crucial issue.
Yeah, I agree. That brings us right back to the point, and a couple sentences down below, it says, truth suppression is not about what the public can stomach, but what the media can stomach. People are eager to hear the truth, and they often recognize it when they hear it, because they go, I can remember my sister sitting around the table having some wine, and 9/11 comes up, and I can't remember what I said, but she didn't know anything, but the official story. And she just looked, and she just went, oh my God. And, I can't remember what I said, but she recognized it was the truth. And that's the way people are. So you have to... people recognize, I can remember one conservative club meeting I was at in Texas, Jim, and one of the members got up and he complained about how the major media are terrible because they allow so-called Soviet journalists on. This is in the 80s, okay? And so that points to, the liberal media, the conventional kind of conservative complaint. And I got up after that and I said, no, the more Soviet journalists, i.e. state mouthpieces, unquote, on the better. Because television is merciless in that respect. People recognize liars on television.
Yeah.
So, this business about we've got to keep the truth from people, and that this comes from the truth movement. How Orwellian is that?
Yes. Yes, very strange, very strange. I mean, either we have a commitment to truth or we don't. I mean, it's something that you spent a lot of time pounding into my head, that either we're committed to the truth, which includes the whole truth and nothing but the truth, or we're not. And if that truth involves psychologically surprising or somehow emotionally distressing realities about the fact that no Boeing 757 hit the Pentagon, for example, that whatever happened in Shanksville appears to be a sham, and there's the real possibility that the planes weren't even present in New York, then we got to bite the bullet. I mean, either we follow evidence and logic, or we start making up fairy tales that are just alternatives to the fairy tales we've been told by our own government.
That's right. If some truths are inconvenient, our job is to make them more convenient, not suppress it or hide it or try and attack the truth messenger.
And as Kevin has said to me during conversations we've had, I mean, the government could have been clever enough in planning this out to know that if anyone discovered the truth, that it would be so bizarre that it would make them look like they were a little off their nut.
Absolutely. Yeah, this would be a good ingredient to build into the plan and help on the cover-up. Help delay outing, and if it is outed, make it incredible.
I mean, it's just diabolical in its ingenuity. But the pieces we're putting together certainly tend to substantiate that.
Yes, and, you know, every once in a while now, this is more of a technician talking, but while I have nothing but contempt for the evil perps, every once in a while you got to admire the ingenuity and the great success these guys
yes.
had in pulling this off. What a huge operation.
Yeah.
And you know, the biggest fraud, the false flag inside job in human history. And they pulled it off. They had to have a lot go right.
Let me tell you something about some of the critics of us as critics. This JREF forum you may be familiar with has a, you know, a rabid band of attackers of 9/11 truth members. And a fellow named Ron Wyke, who has a TV show called Hardfire, arranged for me to come to Brooklyn to debate with Mark Roberts. In fact, of course, I was actually debating them both in a three-part series that would eventually be broadcast, you know, many different places. Now, recently approached me about doing a debate on the Pentagon, and I thought that was a great idea. So I said, well, here are the rules. I said, let us agree on a proposition, which is the official government account, which, of course, you want to defend. Once we agree on what is the official government account, then we can have as many as 12 rounds where you begin by offering evidence to support the official government account, and I criticize you, and then we can have 12 repetitions, and because I'm your guest, I get to have the last word. Well, he said those all sounded very reasonable, and he'd circulate them among his group of experts on the Pentagon. But guess what, Morgan? They're not willing to do it. And, of course, they're not willing to do it because once you have an official account to which they're committed, that is the anvil. I am the hammer, and there's no possible way they're going to be able to prevail. Their technique is not to be rooted in any position, but to just freely and inconsistently attack any position they don't like.
Yes, yeah, create doubt and confusion and have relatively low interest bystanders say, oh, look at that, that's just a waste of time, I can't figure it out, you know.
Well, I told several others that, you know, once I had set up the rules that way, I knew there was no way they would be willing to debate me because it meant there actually was a hard place that they had to defend.
Well, yeah,
it's going to function like a rock.
And that a debate has those that kind of formal structure.
Well,
yeah,
this was going to be a written exchange, and it was all very well laid out. And if there's any topic I would be thrilled to debate anyone about, it's the Pentagon. So all this was perfect for me. But we had to nail down that they were defending the official account, and therefore they had to commit themselves to a version of the official account. And they knew once they did that, they were had.
Yeah, it reminds me of a lot of things, but it's like Gregory S. Jenkins saying
yeah.
that in order to dustify, poof, disappear the Twin Towers, it would take five times the Earth's energy, whatever that means. And the guy is basically arguing, oh, do you mean the towers are still there?
Well, but the absurdity of that, Morgan, as I pointed out, a single atomic bomb would suffice. I mean, what kind of moronism is this? How can people be so dumb as to be taken in by a phony argument like that? What induces them to accept something as stupid as that?
Yeah, I tried to look him up, and he's listed along with a couple of grad students at a University of Maryland College Park campus. It's not too far from the NSA facility. I wonder where he gets his income.
Morgan, I can't thank you enough for coming on. We'll have to do it again. This has been Jim Fetzer, and you've been listening to The Dynamic Duo.